Hey, podcasters, welcome to another edition of Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. I'm your host, Tim Estradol. On this week's episode, we have a lot of interesting news coming out, and we have some great conversations. We're talking oil with a Shell oil engineer. We're talking steel with a representative from the Steel Market Development Institute. We're talking these two basics of automotive and how they're changing and how they're getting more advanced and how they're ultimately going to help you, the consumer, at the pump. We're talking fuel savings. We're also talking some safety, and we're talking some longevity with the engine with oil. Pretty interesting conversation. You don't need an engineering degree to understand what's going on. Trust me, I thought maybe I did because this is highly advanced stuff, but I think you'll understand what's going on with these two products and how they're going to benefit you. But first, let's kind of back up here and talk about the news. The elephant in the room, the one I'm not at, is the SEMA show. I decided this year I have a conflict. I have to be at an event on Thursday and Friday. I'm going to skip that show. It's a huge show. It's really interesting, but it's hard to cover, to be honest with you. It's days and days of walking around exhibit centers in Vegas, these gigantic two-story buildings that are full of modified trucks and Jeeps and sports cars. You'll find a lot of photos on our Pickup Truck Talk Facebook page, also on pickuptrucktalk.com. I have some of the manufacturer entries, which are always interesting because you get companies like Toyota that is very conservative, and they actually put out some pretty interesting products. Last year, they had a Toyota Tundra limousine, and this year they have the Toyota Tacoma TRD Pro Race, which is a stock version of the Tacoma, but it's actually a race set up with racing gear. It looks like it's for a desert racer. And then they made a lowered version of a Land Cruiser. They call it Land Speed Cruiser. They put a twin turbochargers on a 5.7 liter V8, lowered it to ground. They say it's going to exceed 220 miles per hour. It's the fastest SUV in the world. And I don't know how fast you need to get to the grocery store, but that's plenty fast. I also can see the Silverado Carhartt concept we talked about last week. The Bojex, I think it's the Bojex. It's the Ford. It's the orange Ford F-150. Just won the best in show at SEMA. You'll find that post. It's pretty interesting. It's a gray and orange Ford F-150 with some pretty wild styling and lifts and lights, things like that. That's what the show's all about. But also, prior to the show, Volkswagen had a really interesting introduction. They did a on the pier in California, in Los Angeles. They introduced what they're calling the Atlas. This is a new vehicle for them. You're going to see it coming out next year. It is a 7-passenger SUV. It's the largest SUV and largest vehicle Volkswagen's ever produced in the United States. And there's a lot of good reasons for that. But let's first get into the vehicle. Imagine, if you will, kind of like it's kind of like Explorer looking. It's got maybe some Land Cruiser styling to it. It's that size vehicle. It's got three rows. They're going to have five different trim levels for it. It's going to come with a 2.0 liter turbocharged four-cylinder direct injected engine. It's going to get 238 horsepower, and they're going to have a straight naturally aspirated 3.6 liter V6 with 280 horsepower. Both made it to 8-speed automatics. Fuel economy is a big part there. It's going to come in front-wheel drive and also an all-wheel drive. It's going to have their 4Motion all-wheel drive system. It's going to have, you know, latest safety features. You're going to have your blind spot. You're going to have an adaptive cruise control, forward collision alert. It's also going to have some improvements in the interior. If you've read any of my reviews on Volkswagen products, you know over the years that one of the areas I really kind of get after them about is the interior. It's very simplistic. It's very to the point. It's to me, it's very German, which is I'm not trying to be racist at all, but it's very much the simplistic design elements. Doesn't have a whole lot of frills to it. I just feel like for the U.S. market, it could be designed a little bit with more flair, have more style to it. The photos that I've been seeing of this vehicle looks like they have a premium grade level. And this one's got some nicer trim level to it, but it's still pretty a basic design. I think that's one of the key areas that Volkswagen's missing on the U.S. market is we spend a lot of time on the inside of our vehicles too, not just looking at them. And with longer commutes and sitting in traffic, I think the interior quality and interior design's got to be more appealing. It's got to be more interesting. It's still got the same trademark two grill with the logo in the middle, very simplistic exterior design. It's what they needed to do. And I say that because not only is Volkswagen dealing with the Dieselgate issues of being caught lying about fuel economy and losing a ton of diesel sales, they're also haven't kept up the market. You know, and the U.S. market over the past 2 years has gone substantially more towards SUVs and trucks and away from cars. And so let me give you an idea on this. So I just pulled up their sales data for last year. It's October. Today's November 1st. So October sales data came out today. And when you look at year-to-date, year-over-year change, you know, they're well-known for their Golf. Well, that's down 39%. They're well-known for the Golf Sportswagon. That's down 19.5%. The total Golf family is down 16.7% in sales. So they went from 55,000 units down to 46,000 units, and that is a downward trend. When you look at overall, their total Jetta, like all Jetta, they're down 7.7%. Excuse me, the number I gave before was a total Golf. This is the total Jetta, down 7.7%. They're off by 9,000 units. Doesn't sound like a lot, but when these cars have small margins of profit, when you're down 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 units, that's quite a bit of money. The Beetle, people know Beetle. They have the coupe, they have the convertible, down 37.7%. The Passat, down 17.4%. The CC, which is a sedan, if I recall, the car market, I don't understand too much about them. They're down 49.8%. I mean, these are staggering numbers. However, then you get down to the Tiguan. The Tiguan is their small SUV. It's a compact SUV, competes with the RAV4. That's up 24.1%. That's up 6,000 units, and they're able to, in the Tiguan, you can add more trim levels. They actually probably get sold at a higher trim level than you would the sedans. The Touareg, however you want to say that, it's down 43.5%. It's off 3,000. It's a low-volume product, only sells 6,000 units. I would argue that's more about that vehicle needs an update. So you enter the Atlas in this equation. I know that the Ford Explorer sells quite a bit, and the Toyota Highlander are both big vehicles in that marketplace, and that's definitely a market that VW needs to get into. Not having a truck here in the United States is a huge issue for them. Not having more than just cars is a big issue for them, and that's a global thing too. I've talked to people in other parts of the world, from PR agencies to industry professionals, and globally, car sales are down. And when I pull up so here's a good example. I'm pulling up right now because I just happened to think about it. Is I'm pulling up the sales data chart for Toyota. So Toyota has switched from cars from being more of a car company to being a truck. I mean, they're trying to. Nissan is actually probably a better example. Nissan's moving full truck side. They're doing a lot with trucks. But you look at Toyota, they're down 9.1% in the cars. Camry, Corolla, Yaris are down, and Avalon, Prius. Prius is down 27.7%, a huge number. Camry is down 9.4%. But you look at the total truck division, which they include their minivan, the RAV4, the Highlander, the 4Runner, Land Cruiser, Toyota, and Tundra and Tacoma. They have an SUV division, they have a pickup division. They put them all in one Toyota total division of truck. That segment's up 4.1%. And you look at the Highlander sells about 17,000 units. They sold 17,000 units last year. So when you look at VW's numbers, VW is down total, say, about 40,000 units each month. Well, if you enter the Atlas in, and let's say the Atlas takes off and sells 10,000 units, which I think a month would be a really good number for them, you know, they're closing that gap. They're going to close that gap and drops the sales. They're going to close the gap year over year. They're going to start breaking even and get back to profitability after the Dieselgate. They still need a truck. They still need an Amarok in the U.S. They know it. They have to know it by now with the way the market is going and going globally. And then, you know, you watch competitors like Mercedes-Benz unveil a truck who they've never had a truck before in their history. So, you know that's where the market's going. You got to get out there and build for what the customers are buying. And so I think the VW Atlas is a good example of that. It's a good example of reacting to the market. I think it's about 2-3 years too late. You know, I think they should have been a little bit faster in the development process, but, you know, they're getting there. They're going to get there. They're going to increase. I foresee them coming out with more SUV products. I think they're going to end up start dropping some of the emphasis on the Golf and the Jetta. That, you know, they've had a lot of emphasis on those vehicles over the years. And they're good bread and butter cars like Toyota has with their Camry and Corolla. But when the marketplace isn't buying them, you have to adapt what the consumer wants. And the consumer just doesn't want cars. They want SUVs. Why would you want to bend down into a car every day when you just hop into your SUV and you have more ground clearance and you have similar fuel economy that you would have a car 5-10 years ago? And you know what? 25, 35 miles a gallon of SUV, most consumers are happy with that. So that does it for the big news this week. We'll be right back with a conversation with Shell Oil engineer Dan Arce. And welcome back to Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. I'm your host, Tim Estradol. On today's program, we have Dan Arce, Global OEM Technical Manager with Shell Lubricants. We're talking about motor oil. It's an interesting topic. I don't know a lot about oil. I do know back in the day when your engine would have a rod knock, you poured in really heavyweight oil and took care of the rod knock. Or it took care of the sound of the rod knock. So we're looking at new oils for proposed Category 11, which is for your medium and heavy-duty trucks. And we're talking about how we're making the oils differently. So thanks. Welcome to the show, Dan. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Tim. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Yeah, well, we're excited about the changes that are taking place in the new performance category that goes live, or actually the categories that go live, December 1st of this year.
Yeah, and we're talking about new EPA requirements for better fuel economy are going to impact medium and heavy-duty trucks, which means oil, which is a big part of the engine's performance. So you guys are developing new products to make the oil thinner and work for a higher temperature?
Yeah, that's right, Jim. There's a number of things that are going on that are changing. There's new categories that, like I said, are going live on December 1st. One of them called API CK4, which is really a replacement for our API CJ4, which is the highest performance standard we have today, and then API FA4, which are the fuel economy oils. And you know, these oils have had significant improvements in performance. One of the key areas is oxidation stability, so the ability to handle higher temperatures. Some engines are going to be running hotter. And it all goes back to what you said earlier, driving improved fuel economy and reducing emissions, because you know the more we can improve fuel economy, less CO2 emissions that are emitted. So these oils are necessary for the next generation oils in order to achieve those targets of improved fuel economy and lower emissions.
Yeah, we've been dealing with this on the consumer side. The oils that keep getting thinner and thinner. I mean, you can get oil these days is like 0W30, like really thin oil that's made for these engines to, it still lubricates, but it doesn't have as much friction and it creates better efficiency. So we're taking that same concept and putting it to the heavy duty and medium duty truck side.
Absolutely. In fact, actually, you know, it's been trending that way for a few years here. But now, for 2017, all your major truck manufacturers, heavy-duty truck manufacturers, are going to be factory filling with 10W30 CK4 type oils or 10W30 FA4, which is a lighter viscosity than the CK4 oils. But again, doing the same thing reduces internal drag and helps provide better fuel economy.
And then I was reading something as well. Some of these fuels, like the CK, not so much the FA, but that fuel is going to be backwards compatible with some older engines.
That's right. The CK4 oils are going to be fully backwards compatible with the previous CJ4, But you'll get improvements. The CK4 actually provide better oxidation control, better shear stability, and better aeration control. So if you have a piece of equipment, let's say you have a diesel pickup truck that you use in 1540 CK4 oil in right now, you can switch to the CK4 oil without any issues whatsoever. In fact, you'll be getting a better product, better performance, and better, from a shell standpoint, better wear protection as well.
And how immediate will they see the impacts of the benefits of this new oil? I mean, you're talking improved fuel economy and improvements. Is it you change your oil automatically, you're going to see these improvements?
So for those applications, and I'll just throw my caveat out here, those applications that can use the lower viscosity oils, so the API FA4 type oils, yeah, they're going to see a fuel economy benefit. And actually, customers could experience this today. Manufacturers ones are Rotella T50/T40 is our mainline product, but we also sell a lot of our Rotella T5 synthetic blend 10W30. And a customer, if they went from 1540 to the synthetic blend 10W30, we're saying about a 1.6% fuel economy benefit by moving there and going to the next generation, the FA4 product. We'll see even a greater fuel economy benefit. And that is immediate. I mean, from the time they change their oil, they start getting the improved fuel economy.
That's interesting. So that really speaks to why a lot of new vehicles are coming with synthetic straight from the manufacturer and different fuels, because that really does improve the fuel economy. You guys introducing today at SEMA, you have a new oil?
Yeah, we actually have we have our whole portfolio of new products that are coming out. Those that are replacing our CK4 oils, replacing our CJ4 oils. But then one of the other things that we're introducing, we have a lot of very loyal customers that have been asking us for a long time for an oil that they can use in their diesel, but also use in their gasoline application, so their gasoline pickup truck or SUV. And so we are introducing a product that we call our Shell Rotella T Multi-Vehicle 5W30.
Okay.
And so it's a 5W30 viscosity grade. It's a full synthetic oil, and it meets the requirements for heavy-duty diesel, but it also meets the requirements for gasoline applications as well.
So one oil for gasoline and diesel engines.
Correct. So to help simplify, those that only want to carry one oil or those that only want to buy one oil, we have a product for them. And like I said, one of the reasons we really decided to come out with this product is just the feedback that we got from our customers. And saying that, we love the way your Rotella products work in my trucks. You have one that can work in my gasoline pickup application or my SUV. We said, we can find one of those.
Yeah, so it's a very interesting to have one fuel or one oil for all these vehicles, because historically diesels cost more to have oil changes done because there's more parts to them, more the oil filters, more expensive oils. Oil was different pricing. So you have some cost savings, too, when you're buying one type of oil for all your oil changes. It makes that a lot easier.
That's right.
So when you develop these oils, are there specific things you have to do from an engineering side to make them work for both the engines?
There are a number of things that we had to do that are different. There are some requirements, specifically on the passenger car side, for a maximum level of certain components. And what I'm talking about specifically is phosphorus. Phosphorus at too high a concentration has been said to reduce the life of catalyst. So phosphorus is one of the main anti-wear components that we use in the oil. So by reducing the phosphorus, there was concern that what will happen to the wear performance. So what we have to do is design the oil with a lower phosphorus level so that it would provide protection to the catalyst in the gasoline application. Then we had to introduce some non-phosphorus containing anti-wear chemistry to boost it up to make sure that the customer is going to get the wear protection on the diesel side that they're accustomed to with our Rotella products.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really the challenge out of it, is meeting the chemical requirements of the passenger car, but also making sure that we didn't compromise durability in the diesel application. patients as well. And our engineers were able to formulate these products in order to do that and get outstanding wear protection in both gasoline and diesel.
And what kind of testing do you do when you get these oils coming out? I'm assuming you have a lab where you test these. Do you have a specific mile requirement to run these for wear and tear experiments?
So when we do our testing, a lot of our work, you know, this category that I said is coming out December 1st, we actually started our work on that in June of 2011.
Wow.
And it started, it really was for us, a phased approach. We did a lot of work of looking at new unique chemistries, new unique molecules for detergency, for anti-wear, for oxidation, for corrosion, all the different attributes that you want to build into the oil. And we started doing a lot of that back in, 2011, 2012. But then once we got our prototype formulations put together, then we take and we run what we call bench tests in-house. So these are tests that you run actually, on basically on a lab table. And you're looking at, different attributes of the oil, wear and dispersancy and corrosion and stuff. But from that point, we take it to the actual engine qualification, where we have to run certain tests to qualify to be able to make claims. And we'll run those tests that meet our API requirements. Then one of the things that Shell does, and with the Rotella, we take it a bit further, is we put it out in the field, and we run it. And so for our next generation engine oils, we have accumulated to date north of 45 million miles of testing in all sorts of applications and in all sorts of vehicles. So that's heavy-duty trucks over the road. And we got over 50,000 hours in off-highway equipment. We've also run, gasoline vehicles in taxi cabs. We've done, construction equipment. We've done a whole host of different types of vehicles across a whole range of duty cycles where they operate, in order to really demonstrate the performance of our products beyond what the requirements are of just testing it in the lab.
Well, I would think after 45 million miles, you've probably got it narrowed down how it's going to work. that is an absurd amount of testing. Holy cow.
It is a huge amount of testing. There's a lot of people that worked really hard to make sure that this all got done. But, when you have a brand like a Rotella brand, it's very important for us to make sure that our customers' expectations are met.
So oil isn't just oil. There really is differences between the brands, huh?
There really is. And, there's differences between the brands, there's differences in performance, and there's differences in how much, engineering and stuff goes into doing this and testing that goes into developing the products.
Wow. Well, that's really interesting stuff. Thanks for being on the show today, Dan. And we'll be right back with more Pickup Truck and SUV Talk. And welcome back to Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. I'm your host, Tomester Dahl. Our next guest is Dave Anderson. He is with the Steel Market Development Institute. He's got one of those really official sounding titles where he's the Senior Director of Automotive Market and Long Products Program. Welcome, Dave, to the podcast.
Thank you, Tim. It's great to be with you.
We were just recently together in Texas driving at the truck rodeo and experiencing the off-road capability of new trucks with the Steel. And I got to tell you, I learned a lot about Steel down there at the presentation you gave. And I was actually reading, they have a new document on the website. It's, let me give you the website here. You can check it out yourself. It is autosteel.org. They have a 2016 Steel Industry Technology Roadmap for Automotive. Let me catch my breath. Okay. So what they're really talking about here is advanced high strength steel. We're doing a third generation of this. I don't recall the first generation of advanced high strength steel. This is the newer, lighter weight steel for fuel economy. When was the first generation coming out? When did that come out?
Yes, and that's a good question. And part of the technical presentation that I did give at the Texas Truck Rodeo was a review of the evolution of steels that are used in the automotive market from back in the 60s and 70s when there were approximately 5-7 grades being used up to today where there's over 200 grades. The steels, back from the early years were the mild steels and some of the high-strength, low-alloy steels. But when the 90s came along, we started to develop the advanced high-strength steels, the dual-phase, the trip steels, the martensite, and that's really the first generation of advanced high-strength steels. And that's what you're seeing used extensively in vehicles today. I know we had the ultralight steel auto body program back in 1998, which really introduced it. The auto guys have applied it, so those are the first generation of advanced high-strength steels.
Yeah, so we're looking at 18 years now. You guys have been really doing some advanced work on steel, making them, we're talking lighter, we're talking stronger, we're talking safer, we're talking more fuel efficient. And then there's new stamping processes. Can you talk about the cold stamping and hot stamping? I get a little confused on how this all works.
Yeah, and that's another good question. And when you looked at our steel strength ductility diagram at the rodeo, what we show is the strength of the material on one axis versus the formability or the elongation on the other axis. So historically, the automakers have been using the mild steels, which have, a strength of 250 to 500 megapascals with elongations of 30 to 60%. So you can form them. You can think of that as a very formable steel. But as we increase the strength to meet the safety and fuel efficiency regulations, unfortunately, some of the sacrifices have been made in the elongation or the formability. So going from a cold stamped product to all the way up to a hot stamped product. The hot stamped products are done on those steels that might only have 5% elongation. So what they do is take a milder steel with good elongation, heat it up, stamp it, and then quench it to get the strength level. So you have both formability in the mild form, but high strength in the as quenched form.
And when you're hot stamping this and you're forming it, quenching is probably a cooling process. Would that be the right way to say that?
Yes, that is the right way to say that. Either in a very cold dye, so it goes into the dye that the steel is warm up to a red almost heat level, and it's formed into a very cold dye, which will then quench it. Or it is then, if it's a warmer dye, it's formed and then water is introduced to quench it, to give it the microstructure that leads to very high strength steels.
And that's one of the benefits of steel, is that you can form it and shape it, and it holds or holds its shape, right? Versus, say, those other guys, that they lose their shape if they don't do the process right. Steel, you can kind of bend it how you want, and it stays that way.
Well, you're definitely right in the hot stamping operation, because it's a mild steel and has that 30 to 60% elongation. Before you quench it, you can form some very intricate shapes. You can keep that shape even during the quenching operation. As you get up to these higher strength steels, it does introduce some spring back characteristics. So what you have to do is almost overform, realizing the steel is going to spring back a little bit. It doesn't spring back as much as the alternate materials, but it does spring back a little, so you've got to compensate that for in your design and stamping operation.
And, it's really interesting. I was reading this morning on an AutoNews.com article. They're talking about the new Ram 1500. The Ram decided to stay with steel versus those other guys, aluminum. They're going to go with steel, and the reason they're doing that is because they can keep the side character lines of the truck and not worry about losing that over time. They can actually have more design in the vehicle. It won't look so bland. And so there's another benefit I think of steel when I think of it, besides just the fuel economy and stuff, is that overall car designs have evolved. So like we talked about the early 1980s Toyotas and 90s Toyotas all had this bland look, but now with steel, you can get some unique designs as well, can't you?
Yes, and that's, I think, an important point in our discussion on fuel efficiency. Steel is offering lightweighting opportunities to the auto manufacturers using three characteristics in your software and hardware modeling. One is the grade, so if you make it stronger, that helps increase the strength in them. You can use a lighter part. Gauge is the thickness, so you can decrease the gauge as you increase the strength. But also what's very important in this is the geometry. With these steels, you can still get a geometric shape. You can get some nice character lines. You can use that geometry actually to a benefit because it adds stiffness to the panel. You can think of a sheet of paper that's just flat, and you can bend that an awful lot, but if you start to fold it up a little bit, you don't get that same amount of flexibility. So we're adding stiffness with these character lines, which helps also in the weight reduction capabilities.
All right, I got to ask the question. So I grew up in Michigan, and those who know Michigan know that we have this thing called rust, and that it destroys vehicles. And so I was reading on the roadmap, and you're talking, you have some chassis projects where you're talking about the corrosion of advanced high-strength steel and chassis applications. So with advanced high-strength steels and things, are you working on ways to mitigate corrosion? And the 15-year corrosion requirement, is that like is it a government requirement or is it an industry requirement? That's interesting because I think I have two rust spots in my 62 Chevy. So I'd say we're well beyond the 15-year requirement. I think we're doing pretty good with that truck. So the other thing that's interesting about advanced high-strength steel, and I guess I'll say this. I go to a lot of these meetings. I'm in a lot of these conferences. I read a lot of this information. So, you know, the listeners out there may not know this, but as Ford has gone aluminum. They've changed and started using some mixed metals and how they get weight reductions. They're combining steel and aluminum together. And there's some concerns about when you mix the metals, you have some additional corrosion, plus you have some additional repair issues. When they issued that truck, they came up with some guidelines saying you had to have your own separate shop for repairability with your own specific line of tools. And that's something that I think that you've spoken on, is that advanced high-strength steel, you don't have to have those requirements in the body shop. You don't have those requirements in the auto shop. It's repairability is the same as what it has been the last 20, 30 years as far as repairing it and fixing it after dents and dings. And you don't have to change the tools. As we get more in high-strength steel and do additional generations, Dave, do you think that we're going to keep the – are we going to change our tooling to repair it, or is that the repairing process aimed at being the same? We're just going to make the metals better.
Yeah, that's a good observation in that steel vehicles have been the historical vehicles, so I'm not sure of the number, but let's say there's 30,000 repair shops out there. They know how to work with steel. These new advanced high-strength steels do require some different methodologies for repair, but not new tools. You can do it in your shop. Most of this would have to be replaced if it got a kink in it, similar to aluminum, but you could use the same wrenches that you've always used. You don't have to have a special set of tools set aside for advanced high-strength steel repair.
So really what we're saying is automakers are starting to use more high-strength steel. We're creating lighter cars, which is ultimately putting more money in the pocket of consumers because they're able to not go to the gas station as much, and they have a safer vehicle, right?
Yes. Again, the safety requirements are being met by the designs of the vehicle. These advanced high-strength steels are being used. They're offering weight reduction opportunities. Weight reduction means you can get more distance from the same, so your fuel efficiency improves. And we think the consumer costs would go, I don't know about down, but wouldn't be adversely impacted with these new advanced high-strength steels.
No, I got to tell you, the presentations I've been to and the vehicles I've seen, advanced high-strength steel is a very exciting product, and it seems like it's going to be in every press release I'm going to read for the next 10 years. So, well, thanks for being on the show, Dave, and we'll be right back with more Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk.
Okay, Tim, thank you very much for having me. If you've got any questions, I'm always available.
And finally on today's Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk, I'm going to talk about the Lexus 2016 Lexus NX300H. It's a five-door SUV, which means it has the hatch in the back. It's not a hatchback. It just has a door that opens up. Let me explain this differently. It's an SUV. I just had it this week for a press loan, which is a seven-day trial of a vehicle. And I drive it around with my family. I check it out and see if I like it. And Lexus provides the vehicle. They provide the gas. And I can drive as much as kind of I want. It's a 2.5-liter. It's a hybrid version I have. So it's a 2.5-liter four-cylinder engine. And then it has electronic motor as well. And so when you combine those two motors, you have 194 horsepower. And then it is mated to a continuously variable transmission. So that way it manages the fuel economy. So you don't have gears per se. The system works to match up the needs of the engine with the powertrain, the transmission, the continuously variable transmission to give you that power. It's a dynamic torque controlled all-wheel drive, so it's an all-wheel drive SUV. It's the size of, like, say, a RAV4. It's a smaller version. It's a very hot vehicle. The compact SUV market for both small, most non-premium and luxury brands like Lexus is exploding. People want that smaller size. They're not buying the car. They're buying the SUV again, like we talked about earlier in the show, and they want that quality, and that's what this Lexus NX300H fits into. One of the great things about Lexus products, and this SUV is no exception, is how quiet they are. I mean, Lexus engineers must have shoved sound-canceling deadener material throughout every nook and cranny of this damn thing. You're driving around and you can't hear anything. I mean, it's whisper quiet inside. Actually, a funny story. I went to the bank to deposit a check, and you pull up and you stop and you're doing the ATM thing at the bank. And so the vehicle switches to electronic mode. The electric motor kicks in. The gas engine stops. You roll down your window. I thought it was off. I thought I had to turn it back on to keep it to get going. But the reality is you put it back in drive, hit the gas a little bit, or the accelerator, gas pedal, et cetera, whatever, and the electric motor kicks on. And then you drive, and then you as you turn and as you really get on it, if you want to take off fast, the gas engine picks up and it handles that smoothly, where you're not even thinking about whether the gas is on, electric motor is on. They're both working in conjunction that you're just driving. You don't have to worry about that at all. Super comfortable. The radio's nice. It's good sound quality. This one's got the interesting trackpad. So it's a square pad. It's built in the quadrants. And you use your finger to move around the navigation system and to move around the Lexus Inform system and to check out the different options. It's okay. Lexus had the mouse that had a little square and you move that around, and I had a little trackpad, and I don't know. I mean, they're all okay. I don't think we have a good system on the industry standard so far. Everything one I've used is just okay. It's just interesting. Just different ways to move around that navigation system, because now we're having these infotainment screens that have all these different options to them, and trying to get to them is sometimes a concern. It's sometimes difficult to do. The benefit of the hybrid system, I go back, is fuel economy. So fuel economy in this is 33 city, 30 highway, 32 combined. A little bit backwards. Most people, when you see fuel economy, you're thinking it's city is a lot lower than highway, because usually when you're cruising in highway, the gearing of the transmission allows you to idle at a lower speed, so you're not running as high RPMs and you're not burning as much fuel. However, with a hybrid system, you're using more electric motor around town, and so you can get better fuel economy city. You can also get even better fuel economy out of a hybrid than you can a naturally aspirated gas engine, because you can actually hypermile it. You can actually take the time and the effort, and it takes some effort, to drive at a slower speed and slower off stop signs and kind of do those things. It allows you to get better fuel economy because you're able to use electric motor a lot more than the naturally aspirated motor. So you're able to get more, you can get better, improve those fuel economy numbers. I didn't get better than those because I drove it. I wasn't holding back. I was driving it for fun. It wasn't my gas. Lexus provided it. So what the heck? Our model had a ton. The loan model had a ton of cool options. A lot of options built into it because they want me to test this stuff out. And I tested all of it out. It's got a power back door. You press the button and the back door opens and closes. At 18-inch all season tires, at a heated front seats, I had daytime running lights, power tilt and slide moonroof, 10-way driver seat with a lumbar, just things to play around with. Typically a lot of stuff I get it set once and I don't really mess with it anymore. So with those options, we did have a fairly expensive SUV, especially for the compact SUV size. My test loan was $47,818. That's with the $940 delivery, processing, and handling fee. The base model, though, the base of all these options was $41,310. And so, if you don't do the options, like, for example, the Q compatible wireless charger, $220, that's a cell phone specific charger that will charge using the Qi wireless charging system. If you skip that, if you don't need navigation, which if you have Google Maps in your phone or Apple, has their map thing, you don't need it. That's $875. There's a variety of things that you can skip and cut the price down. But it's about I would say anywhere you're going to find it's probably going to MSRP for 45. You could probably get a deal around 43, maybe even less than that, depending on the dealer and depending on the incentives. So, you look at this versus, say, a RAV4, and you're looking at probably a price difference of $15,000, $20,000. But you're getting a lot more quality build. getting a lot more luxury. And so you're paying that higher premium for a vehicle that is about like a RAV4, but has just a lot more features and has a lot more luxury. And it's just, it's better built. Even though they're both Toyota production vehicles, so they both have a higher degree of production, Lexus vehicles are just built to a higher standard. It's just how it is. So I liked it. I mean, it's hard to say anything wrong with it. It's hard to say anything negative. It's got good get up and go. It's got good braking. It handles well. It's comfortable on the road. Road noise is gone. Good luck hearing stuff with this. Price maybe is a concern with certain people because you are going to pay for that. You're going to pay that higher dollar amount. And the fuel economy to me was pretty good. You know, 30 highway. I mean, that's pretty good for a compact SUV. I've seen some SUVs be better with the turbocharged engines and things, but I'm okay with that. I'm okay with 33 city. I think you can get even better than that, like I said. So thanks for tuning in to this week's Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. Make sure you check us out on Facebook on Pickup Truck Talk, and make sure you check us out on iTunes. Send me an email with questions, comments, concerns to Tim at Pickup Truck Talk, and we'll talk to you again down the road. We'll be right back.